Hi, everyone. I'm Megan, and welcome to Word Crash, the game show where authors of all genres can get creative. First off, let's meet our contestants. Joining us today, they're a novelist by night, agile coach by day, and will never, ever turn down an invitation to play pinball, the author of Bait and Switch, The Painted Cat, and A Fuzzy Place, please welcome Austin Crowder.
Hey there.
Welcome. Next up, a bird-brained urban naturalist from Austin, Texas, and author of Interstellar Spring and A Crown of Cobwebs, J. Darris Mitchell.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure, Joe. Well, nothing left to do but get to it. Let's play Word Crash. Today we're going to start with a game we like to call Squeaky Clean. Reboot a gritty book or movie to remove the grit. Austin, you won the coin flip. You go first.
Great. So, Donnie Darko. Really sad movie. Lots of crying. Lots of sadness. Lots of sexual tension. Weird hypnosis. Just yuck. Absolutely, 100%, not my vibe. So I got two pitches, and I want to run both of them by you. One, a G-rated romp with a cartoon rabbit who comes into Donnie's life and teaches him the value of friendship and eventually saves the town from a crashing jet plane. Option two, Donnie Darko, the musical.
Ooh.
I'm down for the animated rabbit. It's got like Who Framed Roger Rabbit vibes, but you know, like darker, we save in the airplane instead of a train thing. So I think I think that's solid. I like that.
It is. Now the big thing is, if it's an animated rabbit, do other people see the rabbit? Who else sees the rabbit?
Oh, nobody sees the rabbit. The rabbit is just there, right? Like, I was kind of thinking that the moment on the golf course where he realizes that, like, fate is pulling him towards, like, his inevitable demise is sort of like a Disney, like one of those really sad Disney songs that traumatizes kids, kind of like Worthless from Brave Little Toaster. So, like, the kid is troubled. He goes to his psychiatrist. He gets hypnotized. Instead of talking about all that sexual tension and ugliness, he sees the rabbit, and the rabbit's like, hey, let's go on time travel adventures, right? So now we've cut out all of the grit. Like, we're just taking a hard right from where the original movie went. And we're just like, we're going off into Fantasia land. We're saving dinosaurs. We're stopping Hitler in like a 3-second scene that's just enough for the adults to be like, I get the joke. We're going back. We're seeing the family is missing Donnie instead of being just sort of emotionally neglectful. Go ahead.
If there was a lot of sexual tension before, right, and that's the topic here, what are we replacing that with? Is it like a soda addiction? Is it...
Ooh, good question. I think definitely video games, Fortnite specifically, or whatever the major video game tie-in of the time. I don't know what the youngs play now. I heard it was Fortnite at one point, but we partner up with the biggest esport. And the bunny is better at it than Donnie, who thinks he's super good at it. Like, he understands where his destiny is to always win at Fortnite.
This sounds like it's going to need a montage. Like, they're going to have to do some training on this game. You know, it sounds great.
I'm kind of thinking, actually, like, the montage is just the bunny pasting Donnie over and over and over and over again. So that Donnie realizes that he's not actually just a sad teenager stuck at home, like a prisoner of fate, but is actually just like bad at the thing that he likes. And now he has to learn to branch out.
Yeah, you know, the games that are always the hardest for me were bullet hells. I don't know. Those are just, they're just insane. I've seen other people play them, you know, but I'm just like, oh, you can't do, how do you, yeah. There's like a million things on the screen and there's lightning and there's, yeah.
This is it. It is we tie in the original golf course. We play homage. It's on a driving range. And Donnie and the rabbit are dodging golf balls. And the rabbit, of course, is like squashing and stretching around every golf ball. Just like, whoop, whoop. And Donnie's just getting pegged over and over and over again. And just a series of long jump cuts. Just like ding, ding, ow, 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 ah. There's at least one like, he gets hit in the butt joke because kids love getting hit in the butt.
Hilarious jokes. I mean,
yeah. And then the rabbit's like, are you willing to believe me now? Like, we got to stop the dinosaurs from dying, or we've got to you know, save your parents who are going to otherwise die in a horrible plane crash. And then Donnie can be like, but I hate my parents. They're bad. And the bunny can be like, well, here's how they're feeling right now. And the parents are despondent because he's unstuck from time and not at home. And like we see the parents missing the kid. And he's like, oh, maybe my parents aren't that bad. And then they see the plane crashing and then they come in and they just yank all the people from the plane. They teleport the plane to the Hudson so that we can get a little bit of that Miracle on the Hudson vibe. Maybe we can get Tom Hanks to guest star and just show up.
Oh, fantastic. I love it. I think that was a great, super clean reboot of Donnie Darko, which has to be one of the most gritty pieces of fiction I have ever heard of. Thank you so much, Austin.
Yeah, I'm more than a little intimidated, but I'll see if I can volley back. So let's see. I think one of my, I don't know how, I think it's pretty gritty. I thought The Matrix was a pretty gritty film. You know, there's leather, there's bullets, there's people coming out of slime. And I was thinking, but like, it has this thing where it's like they're going, you know, he's entering another world. So there's like this kind of video game thing as well. So I was thinking, what if we, you know, it's too dark. What if we make it, instead of The Matrix, The Mariatrix? And it's just like, you know, Neo is Mario, basically. And instead of going into The Matrix, he goes into the world of Mario, right? And, like, we have the agents are, like, the Goombas, and Mr. Smith is Bowser. I think it could work.
I think it could, too. I mean, it could be, I need fire flowers, lots of them, right?
Yeah, totally. Right. Exactly. Yes. In the end, instead of him coming back from the dead, it just the music just boop, 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 doo, boop, boop, doo, boop, 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 doo, doo. And the agents are just like, what? We've never seen this before.
So now I have a really interesting question. Of course, the Mario Brothers are home of one of the most famous reboots of all time. So how are you going to either pay homage to or differentiate your Mariatrix from the absolute classic 90s movie, Mario Brothers?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, it that's a movie that needs to be paid homage to because it's amazing. One of my favorite things about that movie is the fungus, right? Like the king fungus everywhere. So I think it's subtle, maybe, because we're not going to try to eclipse something that amazing. But maybe he gets out of the Mario world, you know, and then he looks around and there's just, instead of those metal towers covered in people, there's just fungus all over him. And he's just like, wait a minute, is this a friend? You know, like maybe that's growing out there.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, if the fungus was actually attached to people's brains and that's how you get into the Mariatrix, right? I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Is that how he becomes the one? He trusts the fungus?
Yes, definitely.
He eats the fungus and it becomes code?
Yes, definitely.
I like it. We're actually treading on some, you know, if we think about it too hard, it could get dark again. Because we're talking about brain fungus, but let's not think about it too hard. I love the idea. And so in order to get into the Mariatrix, you have to jump down a tube or something like that. You don't use, like, you know, something to hook up to you.
No.
Right? You jump
into
the tube.
That would be way too gritty to put that spike in, right? That's super nasty. We don't want that. So, yeah, you just, like, hop down into a tube and, like, yeah, it's nice. Right? And instead of being, like, any injuries you sustain inside can be hurt, they're like, just get some coins and you'll be cool. I'm like, you know, it's like a whole different feeling.
So I feel like the suburban experience, like the whole idea of these like go away from home movies is like, I am a suburban child of moderate wealth who has two parents that love them, and I'm going to go on an adventure at the movies. So I have to know, how do we find the pipe?
Yeah, that first pipe. How does Mario know to go there?
Yeah. I don't know. You know, it's like he's got to start inside of the Mario world. It's like it's almost he needs that pipe to escape.
Wait, so, is Morpheus Toad? If Morpheus is Toad and Morpheus is looking for Mario, right?
Yep. Neo, your princess is in this castle.
Yes. Yes. And something about Trinity. Are we going to make Trinity Princess Peach?
I think this is one part where we stay true to the grit, and she comes out in the pink and then she just rips it off black leather underneath and we're just like, okay, you know, and it's still like, I think that could work still.
360 cam or I'm not buying. Like 360 cam to leather or we're not doing this movie.
Yes, definitely. All the way around. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
So basically, this has to be Peach from Smash Brothers, right? With a little bit of Bayonetta thrown in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, y'all are killing it on the video game references. I'm like, oh, dude, how do I even?
I feel like the 360 cam, black leather, Princess Peach enters the battle with, like, the big Smash Brothers, like, Chiron coming across.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. That would definitely be different, and I could totally see the Matrix. Now, who's the betrayer, right? Because the Matrix had a betrayer.
Yeah. I mean, would it make any sense for Mario to trust Wario in the beginning of the movie? Like, the audience would be like, that guy's mustache is totally out of whack. We don't trust him at all. But maybe, you know, as the protagonist, sometimes it's fun as a reader or a viewer to know things your narrator doesn't know. And you're like, that guy's outfit is the opposite of yours, Mario. Don't trust him one bit, you know? I don't know.
No, I love that. Cypher as Wario. I was going to say Luigi, but that's just a little too much betrayal, right?
Yeah,
nobody really
harsh.
Loved Cypher in that movie. He was just somebody they all dealt with, you know? So yeah, Wario is Cypher. Who else is left? Switch, Tank, Mouse. I don't know. Are they super
yeah,
important?
Mouse, you know, I was thinking Mouse for Toad, but Morpheus's Toad is so much better. So it's really, I mean, it has to be that.
I don't know. Toadette maybe for Mouse or Switch. I don't know. Everybody else is kind of, you know, they're important to the plot, but that's super important to the plot. So, you know, we could make them random Toads.
I mean, yeah, compared to the plot of Mario, all other plots are kind of extraneous. Like, it's just kind of extra compared to that, where you're like, get the princess in the castle. It's like, whoa, we have, you know, other levels. So
there were the big machines with all the tentacles and stuff. What do we use for those?
I think the vines that you climb are piranha plants. Like, you're being bit by a piranha plant around your head. Very visceral. It, like, lets go and then goes back into its little pipe, and then you get flushed down another pipe. Mm. Look, it's Mario. You got to have a lot of pipes.
Yeah, it's something that's in both.
Well, this is fantastic. I love the Mario 8-bit reboot of The Matrix. I think it would be fantastic and sell a billion copies. On to our next part. We call this secret sauce, where our authors share a technique or strategy used to keep them, you know, creative and unblock themselves. Joe, do you have a technique you'd like to share with us today?
Yeah, I do, for sure. My secret sauce I recommend is gardening. I have a big vegetable garden and flower garden in the backyard. And there's if I'm stuck or I'm just procrastinating, if I go outside and I, you know, water something or rip something out of the ground, it's like I'm able to see a change as soon as it happens. You know, it's like I took out that weed, that plant's no longer dying. And that kind of gives me encouragement for writing, because sometimes when you're writing, it's like, you know, you can write 1,000 words and you have to get rid of them because it's just junk or whatever. And so, like, seeing the process of the garden helps me, and it also helps just to, like, get outside and kind of clear my head. So, like, I recommend finding some place where you can dig in the dirt. Also, it's great for, like, sensory details and all that kind of stuff.
There was an author, I can't remember his name, I'm sure in the comments people are going to call me out for not knowing his name, but there was an author who used to have his wife read incredibly dry books to him, like scientific books, incredibly dry stuff, and that would occupy the part of his mind that was involved in all that and let the free thinking part of his brain go, right? And so I have a feeling that when you're gardening, you're letting a chunk of your brain go, and the, you know, by focusing on a very mundane task, and it's fun, but, you know, a mundane task, and getting that creativity flowing. You know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I think I think Michael Pollan wrote a book called Second Nature where he talks about gardening, and he talks about, like, when you're gardening, you enter, like, a flow state where you're just like, this needs pruned, this needs plucked, this needs planted, this needs watered. And entering that state is, like, what I want to get to when I'm writing, but it's kind of hard when you're just staring at a screen. So it's like, if I can get that going, and then it's like, oh, that is why she needs to do that. And then I can, I don't know, I think it's just a useful place and away from the, for me, it's like, I got to get away from the computer. If I open up, like, Reddit, then it's like, there goes my day. I'm doomed.
Yes, yes. At least I know the addictive quality of Reddit. I have spent many, many an hour on Reddit. Austin, what's your secret sauce?
So I have kind of like a push-pull relationship. I stick with write crap, forgive myself, and why should I care? So I'm of the opinion that anything that a person writes is ultimately an expression of themselves. Like, the worlds that we're creating aren't these crazy fantasias that are outside of ourselves. They are extensions of our experiences as humans. And sometimes your experiences as a human being are crappy. Like, sometimes it's okay to write just the garbage that's been eating at the back of your brain. For example, what if Donnie Darko was a cute, fun romp, right? Like, Gal, go ahead and spend 1,000 words on that. I'll get it out of my head. I'll have some fun. It's low stakes. I know that it's not prestige. I know that it's not going to sell. But, like, it's 1,000 words. It's a lot of fun to write. I'm going to enjoy myself. And I'm probably going to learn something about my craft while I'm doing it, because I'm doing something that's outside of my comfort zone. On the other side of that, when I am writing, I'm always asking myself the question, from a reader's perspective, why should I care? I have a world built in my head that is very vast and detailed and put together, and I understand why everything's going on the way that it's going on. But if I'm the reader, I don't care about this fancy, beautiful world inside my head. I want to know, who am I reading? Like, who am I following? Why am I following them? Why should I care? And the way you do that is by establishing an emotional connection to the character. I find that the best worlds that I've built and the best stories that I've written are the ones where I started out with kind of a basic idea of how the world is going to work. And then I melded it and I molded it to the way the character wanted to develop. Because eventually, like, I'm going to end up saying something about my own personal experience. And the more I let the world reflect my personal experience and show sort of the prejudices and the biases and the ideas that I hold dear, one, the easier it's going to be to write. Two, the more others are going to read it and resonate with the people that I'm writing about.
You know, I read a book by Johnny B. Truant called Write, Publish, Repeat. And one of the things that they say is that you really want the people who are going to love you for you. So chasing trends or writing books that you think are going to be popular probably isn't going to be the best expression of you. And the best expression of you and people who like that is how you get fans, as opposed to just people who buy a book. So when you're talking here about, you know, these worlds being an expression of yourself, anyone who likes you, right, for you, will read all of it. Mm-hmm. And they will never get enough.
The two sides are both very important. I keep Tim O'Brien's quote, fantastic author, Vietnam War veteran, writes a lot about his experiences. His quote is, a lie sometimes can be truer than the truth, which is why fiction gets written. And that's what I want my fiction to be. I want it to be an extension of myself. I want it to be my truth that I put out in the world. But by doing that, I have to, like, go through and I have to write crap, basically. Like, I have to sometimes let that go, and I'm going to write something super stupid. And it's going to be funny, or it's going to be sappy, or it's going to be terrible, and I'm never going to publish it. But I have to do it, because otherwise I'm going to get stuck in being pretentious and I'm going to block myself.
Joe, yeah, you want to say something?
Important. Yeah, I just really like that. I think it's really important. I've worked with a lot of writers that want to write the perfect story, and they want to write something that's 100% flawless, 100% perfect, and it's just impossible. It's just not possible, especially if you're trying to reach more than one person. Like, maybe you could write the perfect story for one person, but if you want more than one person to read it, it's just impossible. So it's like, I really love that. Like, I try to make a story that's 85% as good as I want it to be. And if it's better than that, I'm like, great, I can move on to the next one now. And then my 85% is going to get better and better. But it's like, I think if you try to get to 100% or 99% perfect, you just end up revising and revising and revising and revising, and it's never finished. So yeah, I love that. I think that striving for, like, good enough, or like being willing to write some crap and be like, I'm going to revise this, or I'm going to cut it. You know, like, I think that's very important.
I love that every writer has that story of just the perfect story that I'm never going to publish, but keep revising.
Oh gosh, it's so sad. Have you ever met writers and they're like, I'm not good enough to write this story. I'm not going to write it ever. And I'm just going to wait. And I'm like, no, just write it. Just write it, write it, write it. And then you can, you know, your next story is going to be even better. You know, like, no, but this idea is so good. And you're like, no, just make it happen. It doesn't have to be perfect. Like, nothing, you know, I just, perfection, nothing's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a saying, perfection is the enemy of good.
Yes.
This every time I hear people talk about this, it reminds me of something I read on Reddit, of all places, where Paul Reed Smith right? This guy who founded his own guitar company, like, from scratch. It was him. In the beginning, it was entirely his talent to make, you know, and now he makes some of the most expensive and beautiful guitars ever. And he talked about the fact that, you know, he's like, people come to me and say, I've always wanted to build a guitar. I've always wanted to build. And he's like, well, then you got to do it. The first one's going to be cruddy, right? The next one might be better. The next one might be better. And eventually you'll get better. But you gotta do that cruddy thing first, right? And for writing, it's the same thing. You know, as Austin said, you got to forgive yourself and you got to realize that it's a process. And if you lock up because I can't do this one thing well, or it's going to need editing, or I can't spell for crud, you know, whatever that is, you just got to do it. Oh, you let go of those that keep us back and just do it. Great. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for that. That's definitely the kind of techniques we're looking for secret sauce. It's time to put on your spacesuits and rocket packs, because it's time for In Space, the game where contestants add In Space to any book or movie and tell us the plot. Joe, you go first.
All right. So so I thought about this one. I really love Nacho Libre. I think it's one of the greatest movies. Talk about fart jokes. I think it's one of the greatest movies ever. Like, it's got everything in it. It's got a man's struggle with faith, his struggle with love, with belonging. Like, also, it's got sweet wrestling moves, which is great. I'm wearing a wrestling shirt. I'm all about wrestling. But anyway, so I think it's just great. And so I was like, but what if it's in space, right? You have, like, this ragtag duo from Earth, right? They've never won. They're, you know, they're trying to work their way up. And so it's like, okay, so Earth hasn't won for like nine sessions. And like, this is the 10th one. And so they got to go for it, right? And so like, they're going to fight all these different aliens and they have to survive. And it's like a battle to the death. And then I was like, oh, wait, this is just Mortal Kombat. I just came up with Mortal Kombat.
Well, I think a comedy Mortal Kombat with Nacho Libre would be great. So at some point, they're going to have to wear spacesuits that look exactly like their uniforms from Nacho Libre, right? Right, yeah. Now with the helmet, yeah, that you put it on and it's got the mask on it.
I think he has to have the Nacho Libre space helmet mask. Mm-hmm. And like, a part of a lot of, I mean, that movie specifically and a lot of wrestling matches, like, take that mask off. And like, that adds a whole nother level in space, because some, you know, when you're taking off Nacho's mask, you're like, you're just going to discover your true identity. It's fine. But in space, it's like, no, don't discover your true identity. No.
So, question. In Nacho Libre in space, what is the gravity level of the wrestling ring? Like, are we talking like 0G pile drivers? Are we talking about variable gravity? Are we talking about like all six walls of plexiglass wrestling action?
See, that's what I was thinking, is we have ropes just all the way around, so it's like full 3D. But I think if we're going to be true to the soul of Nacho Libre, Nacho always is expecting a different gravity than it is. So he's ready for the full 3D, and then he bounces off the top and it slams him back down. You know, like, he's never fully prepared. And the other guy always, you know, they always know exactly how it's supposed to work.
I love the idea of, like, the pall bearer of this Nacho Libre world with, like, control of the gravity. And just like, but Nacho's like, no, it is time for true lucha libre. And then just goes to town.
Gonna be good.
So what kind of alien species are we looking at here for him to fight, right? I definitely think tentacle monster. He's got to fight a tentacle monster. That's a given. What else is he going to fight? And which bad guys, you know, are going to be what?
Yeah, for sure. Well, so he's got... I think the big bad, you know, in the movie is Ramses, who's like this golden idol guy. He's, you know, he's greased up and oiled. So I think it's like we just go with like full gold metal alien, just like dripping oil, like a full robot thing. And so it's like lubed and powerful. It's uncomfortable. It's got like weird lips. I think that's like, that one's kind of done. And then we have the Devil's Cavemen, which, I mean, that's kind of, I don't know. Sometimes you get into trouble, but I'm like, Ewok crossover, maybe, you know?
Yeah. Is there a different moral to the story because it's in space? Is there a different reward at the end? What are we going to get to at the end?
Yeah, I don't know. There's so much in Nacho Libre. I mean, as I said, perfect film, so it's hard to say. I mean, it's going to be hard to top that, but it's like, yeah, I don't know what a space orphanage looks like. You know, that's going to be a whole different thing. So like, what's his relationship with a space orphanage going to look like? And instead of him like working so hard to feed these kids leftovers, like, I don't know if you can feed a bunch of alien orphans leftovers. I'd imagine there's like a pretty specific dietary thing going on. So I don't know. The more I'm thinking about it, I think he has a whole different role in the organization. Like, instead of him just being like this guy that's making lousy food, it's like he's got to kind of be a dietitian, because you're going to have to feed Children of the Tentacle Monsters, the Children of the Robot with the Gold, the Children of the Space Cavemen. You know, so it's complicated.
What if it's a whole planet of orphans? He has a whole planet. Up the stakes here. There's a whole planet of orphans that need to be saved.
Great. This is something I didn't think about in this game, but within space, you can make the stakes that big. So, like, yeah, it could be. He's not. It's not an orphanage. It's the planet orphanage. Yeah, I love that. Oh my god. Yes.
And it would be fantastic to see him sitting down trying to counsel people about, so what kind of stuff do you eat? You know, and each alien is talking about something that's, you know, horribly disgusting or something that we would never eat. You know, like the tentacle monster's like, I eat brains. Do you have some brains? And he's just like, brains? And he's writing it down, you know, disgusted.
Love it.
Does Nacho Libre have a tag partner in this intergalactic championship? Because I feel like every heavyweight champion has a tag partner, because you're also going for the tag team championship. So, like, you thought about that? Got someone in mind?
He's got his tag partner, a Skeleto. So I'm like, can you have a space skeleton? I mean, I don't know. Like, it gets kind of loosey-goosey. But I think that he, you know, maybe his tag team partner has grown up on this orphan, and he's somehow, like, you know, gotten into the cracks. And so he's like from the streets or something. But I think it's someone, a survivor of the orphan.
That is fantastic. I would pay to see this movie. All we got to do is change Nacho Libre's name. And I think you'll have your next big hit, Joe. Just your next big hit. This is it.
I love it. It's even better than Mortal Kombat. I love it.
Austin, what do you have for us today?
So, everyone loves the Emmy-nominated show Pose. You've got Ballroom, you've got Trans People, you've got Reading, you've got Shade. So it's 1988. Trans people in New York scuffling in the ballroom. They are abducted by aliens, and the thing they bring to galactic civilization is Ballroom.
I love it. I'm hooked.
The USS House of Shade. Or I guess it would be like the ASS, the Alien Space Syndicate. The ASS, House of Shade, travels to all of the galactic starports, where usually you would see all of the rabble-rousers, the ne'er-do-wells, the orphans, the people living off, like, the dirt pits of, I don't know, Scarrow or whatever, right? Instead of being stuck there, they are adopted by the House of Alien Shade. Or Extravaganza, I'm not sure which. We can workshop the house names later.
Yeah, totally workshop the house later.
To participate in giant ballroom competitions in zero-G on the space stations of the galaxy. And truly, Earth's greatest gift to the world is the idea that gender is just a construct, or proboscis, or, you know, some sparkly dresses.
I would love to see a slime monster in a sparkly dress, like, you know, some kind of slime monster doing ballroom in zero G in a sparkly dress. If you're a slime monster, maybe you don't have, maybe you can't dance normally in normal gravity, right? And who's going to want to dance with you because you're a slime monster?
That's my question. Are we in zero G? And then what are the clothes? Do aliens have the same aesthetic? Does everybody like a skirt that, or a dress that flies out, you know, that comes out when you spin?
So I feel like you got to reel it in a little bit to keep the audience, like, grounded. Because you have to have a little bit of, like, the human ideas of gender, but you have to apply them to alien species. So I think there are challenges on different star bases where, like, one, they have the very traditional ballroom. They have the idea that we hew to the traditions of the Earthlings. And they have, like, a traditional ballroom. They've shopped for and, like, sourced incandescent lights, which are these just rare, like, gems of the galaxy at this point. Sometimes you go to a star base and they're like, well, here on Meep Mop 7, we only dance in zero G. And, like, the gravity gives up and everyone, like, flies up. The dresses get all floaty and flowy and bally. But I think you have a lot of opportunities to investigate gender. So, like, does it count as drag if the slime monster is wearing a dress or wearing a suit coat, or, like, does the slime monster even understand the concept of clothes?
So I have a question. So, like, ballroom is normally a pair of people dancing. Is this correct?
So, in this case specifically, this is like from the 1980s. Trans people and gender nonconforming and queer people would get together in giant ballrooms, and they would participate in categories. And so they would try to serve up a kind of realness, like serving fish, or like feminine realness, or military realness. And they would go out and they would buy outfits to pretend to be that thing on stage and try to pass themselves off as that thing. So there was like butch queen realness. So it was guys dressed as butch as they possibly could to try and be the butchest person on the floor, or femme queen realness. So people would wear dresses and like really try to like be the most passable version of themselves as they could. So this is like a competition to adhere to some sort of category or norm, but it's in space. So we can explore the idea that all these norms are just completely, they don't apply.
Well, I think there could be fun if the different alien races have different gender norms. And so each race, if this kind of alien has only one gender and then they have to go to the planet where there's five genders, then how do you do that? If you go to a world that doesn't even have a gender that you're even familiar with at all, like that's a lot of fun, you know? And then there's,
yeah,
you're talking about like, you know, variations on gender. So then it's like, well, this, you know, this one alien on this one planet, they just, everyone's just G and it's cool. But then they go into this contest and it's like, what am I? Who am I? You know, that's fun. I like it.
You have all kinds of situations where, you know, like, let's go back to the tentacle monster. So how many high pairs of high heels does a tentacle monster wear when they dance?
Good question. I think it depends. I feel like that could be an episode that's like its own sort of after school special. The tentacle monster trying to get as many high heels as they can because they want to do this ballroom walk in Earthling femme queen realness. And someone's like, girl, you don't have to have 15 pairs of heels. Your tentacles are beautiful just the way they are. And like the end is just this tentacle monster coming out in like two pairs of platform pumps and the tentacles waving everywhere. And they've like found themselves and they've found their gender identity. And this is like who they are.
I love it. I want to watch it with a glass of wine. Sounds great.
Yes. I'm sure there's quite a few tear jerking moments in there too. Yeah.
Yes.
I'd like to give everyone a few minutes to talk about what's new in your life and what's exciting. Austin, do you want to go first?
Building up my presence on Itch just to do some self-publishing. I've got a number of short stories that I'm looking to turn into compilations, including a couple of novellas and stories that I'm really excited about. Stay tuned to my Itch space. There will be more stuff to come. So if you look up Arcade System, you'll find us.
If anyone's interested in your prior work, where can they get that?
Right. You can find me on Amazon. If you just look up Austin Crowder, Painted Cat, A Fuzzy Place, and Bait and Switch.
Fantastic. Thank you. Joe, what do you have going on?
Yeah, so my next book coming out with Indies United is called The Crane and the Wolf. It's coming out mid-August, I believe August 18th. And it is it's a fantasy piece. So basically, have you guys seen The Great British Bake Off?
Yes. I hope.
Right. Yes. Okay. So the idea is, imagine it's the Great British Bake Off, but instead of Paul Hollywood, you have a werewolf who, if he is not satiated by the time the full moon is overhead with the perfect baked cake, he just murders everyone. So that's like kind of where we start. So like that's the book. And so it's about like three main bakers. So we have Opal, who's like the baker, like, maybe she's from season 7. I don't know, where it's like, her food tastes so good, but it looks bad, and she just doesn't believe in herself. So she's always crying, you know. And then we have the older baker whose bake just looks like perfect. Like it just looks amazing. But like even the kids at the school she teaches at are like, lady, this doesn't taste too good. And then we have our wild card Boffo, who's always been traveling, who has like a good taste, and he's trying to figure it out. So it's about these three people each trying to become the winner of this competition, so they get, you know, a vast fortune and everything. It's called The Crane and the Wolf. And I think it's a lot of fun. It's going to be out by Indies United, August 18th. So check it out. I'll have pre-orders and stuff up soon.
And Joe, where can people reach you?
You can find me on jdurismitchell.com. I update my blog bi-weekly. It's called News from the Bubble Phone. So you can find out about what I'm working on. You can find out about what I'm doing with my garden and with my kids, and then I do the bird of the week. So whatever the best bird I saw that week is, I will definitely let you know on that. So you can subscribe to that newsletter at jdarrismitchell.com or just check it out there.
Now it's up to you, audience. Who was the victor today? Did you like Donnie Darko, the animated series? Nacho Libre in space? Or maybe you really liked being given permission to write crap when you need to? Cast your vote by sending us a tweet at WordCrashGame. If you're listening on YouTube, remember to like and subscribe and get in those comments and tell us how you would tackle our questions today. Thank you for listening. I'm Megan, and this has been Word Crash, reminding you to always get creative.